Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The nuclear disaster at the Chernobyl plant in Ukraine, which was still part of the Soviet Union in 1986, probably got more attention in Pennsylvania than other places. That's because the worst commercial nuclear accident in the U.S. was at Three Mile Island south of Harrisburg in 1979. However, even though the world knew Chernobyl was the world's worst nuclear accident, we didn't know just how much of a catastrophe it was. Now we do. Journalist Adam Higginbotham's best-selling book, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster, has details that those outside a small circle of people in the Soviet Union never knew. I spoke with Adam Higginbotham about Midnight in Chernobyl last week at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. Let me reiterate the title. New York Times bestseller, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. Adam Higginbotham, most people could and would identify Chernobyl as the worst nuclear disaster in world history. But give us a quick synopsis of why it was worse than all the others. I know it's hard to do quickly.
I guess it's much bigger in scale in that it released such an enormous amount of radioactive material that spread over such a wide area that persists in the environment until today. I think that's and it affected a much larger number of people than any other nuclear accident. Ultimately, I don't know whether I think I'd put up. There, that's probably better. It ultimately affected an area of Belarus, the Russian Republic, and Ukraine that contained 5 million people. So that's, I mean, that affected an enormous number of people. So that's what really makes it the biggest nuclear disaster in history.
What inspired you to write about Chernobyl?
I'm kind of ashamed to admit the original reason that I started to work on the subject, which was that back in 2005, I was looking for the next story to write. And, I'd been writing kind of narrative nonfiction for a while, and I was looking for a new story idea. And I eventually resorted to the kind of the most shameful device in journalism, which was to find myself an anniversary. And so worse still, it was, late 2005, so I looked at the Wikipedia calendar. It's 2005. I'm planning ahead, so I'm looking at 2006 anniversary. So I go back. I look at 1996. It's December, November. It's not much going on in 1996. Really, the world was largely at peace. It was, it was a good time to be alive. You start going back 1986. It's quite a lot of stuff happens in 1986. But I get to April 19, and I'm like, oh, the Chernobyl disaster. Yes. There could be something in that. And it also coincided with me having just read A Night to Remember.
About the Titanic.
Which is Walter Lord's brilliant book about the Titanic. But I'm sure a lot of people here have read it, but it for those that haven't, it just concentrates on the night of the sinking of the Titanic. And it's based on interviews that Lord himself did with survivors, and on mining the records from the Congressional Inquiry and the inquiries in Britain. And it's a very concise, brilliant narrative of these events. So I thought, well, I could write a magazine story that just does this for the Chernobyl disaster. So I just need to go and find myself some eyewitnesses. So that was initially what happened, is that I persuaded my editors at the Observer magazine in London to send me to Moscow and Kiev to go and find, a handful of survivors to reconstruct from their testimony, the events of that night. But what happened is that as soon as I started talking to those people, I discovered that the existing books that I'd read as background research before I left, just had huge holes in the story. And things that were either missing or wrong. And moreover, some of the people that I spoke to kind of told me things about what they'd witnessed, where even in 2006, I was sitting there thinking, I cannot believe that you are still alive to tell me about having seen this stuff you know, given what you saw. And the stories of everyone, I was probably interviewed, I mean, a dozen people on that reporting trip, but each one of them had this absolutely incredible story. So as soon as I came back to New York, I think possibly before I'd even finished drafting the piece, I went to see a book agent, because I didn't have a literary agent. So I went to see one, and I was just filled with enthusiasm for this story, because I was just blown away by what a kind of amazing group of human stories was contained in what I'd discovered so far. And I was in his office for about 90 seconds trying to pitch this thing to him before he started looking over my shoulder to see if there was somebody more interesting to talk to. And it took me another 8 or 9 years to convince somebody to let me write a book about it.
So if I look over your shoulder tonight, you know that...
I'll get the message pretty quickly. I've seen it before.
Now, as we will find out, there was a lot of secrecy, not surprisingly, in the Soviet Union, but there were a lot of myths, a lot of misinformation, just a lot of information that the world didn't know. Even though you were in Ukraine and the Soviet Union had collapsed, how did you get access to these people? How did you get access to the records and the information? Because if the Soviet Union still existed, you probably, a Western journalist, would probably never have seen this.
No, not at all. None of it. The truth is that documents and archival material about the accident began coming out not as soon as the Soviet Union collapsed, basically. Those documents started emerging. Because what happened was Boris Yeltsin outlawed the Communist Party and then attempted to put the Communist Party on trial. And part of the case against the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was that they had failed in their duty of care to the Soviet people. And one of the principal pieces of evidence that he used in this case was the Chernobyl disaster. So as a result of that, in support of that case, they released a huge tranche of material that had been up to that point classified. And as soon as that happened, a group of researchers from Stanford swept in, committed all of that stuff to microfilm. And so that's the first sort of tranche of classified material that was released. And that now I saw it in the library at Harvard, but it's been copied all over the world. And gradually over the years since then, you know, a lot of different bits of the story in archival material have come out. And in terms of getting hold of the people themselves, I mean, I had an enormous amount of help. I had researchers and fixers in Moscow and Kiev. But the most crucial help that I had was from the Chernobyl Museum in Kiev. And that is overseen by this woman, Anna Korolevska, who, you know, has spent more than 20 years kind of curating this huge amount of archival material and documents and mementos and memorabilia, but also curating the people associated with the accident. So me and my fixer Taras went to see her right at the beginning of work on this, on the book project, and explained to her what we were doing. And at first she just told us that this was impossible, that no one could possibly write an objective history of the Chernobyl accident. But we kept going back and talking to her more and more, and eventually kind of brought her around to our point of view. And I think that in the end, she thought that, you know, it was still this kind of stupid, quixotic enterprise, but we were at least sincere, so that she'd give us a hand. So she had the telephone numbers and the contact details of lots of people who she would put us in touch with.
Before we go to that fateful early morning in April, I want to kind of set up what Chernobyl looked like, what I was going to say the countryside, but what the surroundings of Chernobyl looked like. What did it look like in 1986, before the accident?
Well, this is actually one of the things that really made me want to write a book about it, because you know, before I started reporting on the subject, it was easy to get the impression, I really had the impression that this was, you know, a sort of stereotypical Soviet experience, where this was a place of, you know, grim monochrome tower blocks, and people living this terrible benighted existence, and the lives of people who worked at the Chernobyl plant and lived in Pripyat, the Atomgrad that was built to house them. You know, it was grim before the accident, and then after the accident, it was grim in a different way. But that wasn't true at all. So what I discovered is that as soon as I started talking to people who lived in Pripyat, it became clear that it was a great place for many of them to live. It was very well appointed, very well resourced. The Ministry of Energy in Moscow made sure that money was provided to provide the city with things that you didn't get in other Soviet cities. So there were swimming pools, beauty parlors, there was a yacht club, there was a scuba diving club. And it was also surrounded by this beautiful countryside. The city was built on the banks of a river, and it had these white sand beaches. And you could take your boat out on the river in the summer. You could go sailing. It was a really great place to live. And some, I think, a third of the population were children. It attracted nuclear specialists from all over the Soviet Union.
Yeah, but the city was built for, specifically, to work at the plant, right?
Exactly.
There was no Pripyat before.
It was a company town.
Right.
No. In 1970, when they began the project, there was nothing there at all. There was a sort of peasant village by a river of, you know, 10 or 15 houses. But they built the city from scratch to accommodate workers at the plant. The Chernobyl plant before the accident was one of the jewels in the crown of the Soviet nuclear industry. It was, on paper, it was one of the best performing plants in the Soviet Union. It was a magnet for specialists from all over the USSR.
But when you look at photographs of Chernobyl, the plant before the accident, they're much different than what we're used to seeing here in America. I mean, what many of us are used to seeing is the Three Mile Island cooling towers, the containment building at TMI. The Chernobyl, I don't know about other Soviet plants, but the Chernobyl looked nothing like that. For one thing, it did not have a containment building. And for those of you who may not be familiar, but just think about Three Mile Island. You have the cooling towers, but you had that building, kind of the round top, over top of the reactors. Did not have that at Chernobyl, and that was significant, wasn't it? Well, maybe I should ask the question, why wasn't there a containment building?
It was geometrically very difficult because the reactor itself was absolutely enormous. At the time it was built, it was 20 times by volume larger than any kind of comparable Western reactor. But it would also have made it extremely expensive if they built a containment dome over the reactor. It would have doubled the cost of construction. And they did everything they could to save money.
And that wasn't the only thing that, and I'm going to talk about some of the history of Soviet nuclear plants, but they were thinking often about money. They were thinking about deadlines. There was a lot of pressure from the government when they were building Chernobyl, wasn't there?
There was, much as there was in any Soviet manufacturing enterprise, it was a huge amount of pressure to get things done. You know, according to deadlines that were sort of artificially imposed and quite often ridiculous. You know, I spoke to one engineer who remembered sitting in a meeting with their party superiors in the early 70s and being told that the reactor would have to be online by the end of the year. And everybody sitting in the room knew that the reactor was currently simply a hole in the ground filled with concrete. And this was simply impossible. And they just kept repeating the same thing. You know, this guy would say, but, comrade, we can't do that. It's a hole in the ground. And he would say, it must be online by the end of the year. And, you know, that's how it worked, is that you were constantly held to these absurd deadlines that everybody involved knew was absurd, but you had to go on regardless.
I think your whole book is an indictment of the Soviet system. I mean, these deadlines, I mean, just what you said, I'm surprised that some of the people around the table even spoke up because they were afraid to.
Right.
When there would be people from the Communist Party or their superiors who would say, this must be done at this date, that they were afraid of getting fired or worse.
Right.
I mean, that happened often, right?
Well, people would get dismissed or given assignments that they didn't want. And part of the problem at Chernobyl was that it was such an attractive posting that once you were there, you weren't going to do anything to rock the boat because you didn't want to be sent off to, you know, somewhere in Siberia to work at a nuclear plant on the edge of nowhere.
All right, so let's go back to the early morning hours of April 26, 1986. What preceded an explosion and fire at the Unit 4 reactor at Chernobyl was a test. What was being tested, and how did that test lead directly to the disaster at Chernobyl?
It was a safety test that actually was supposed to have been conducted on the reactor before it came online in commercial operation, more than 2 years before, at the end of 1983. And it was, ironically, a safety test that was intended to test a device that would keep the water pumps of the reactor going in the event of a power cut. Because the way that the nuclear plant worked, it couldn't generate electricity to keep its own lights on, or indeed run the water pumps that circulated cooling water through the reactor. That electricity had to come from the grid. So if there was a power cut and there was a total blackout on the grid, then they would need electricity from somewhere to keep the pumps going. And they had emergency diesel generators that would kick in to make this happen. But there was going to be a pause while the generators came up to speed. And that pause was deemed long enough, potentially long enough, that a meltdown could begin in the reactor core. So they wanted another device that they could use to bridge this up to 3 minute gap in which the diesel generators would start circulating the water again. And so they devised this method where these giant turbine generators that they had to generate electricity from the power plant, from the nuclear reactor, as they span down, that their inertial energy would supply enough electricity to keep the water circulating through the reactor core. So this is the device, this rundown generator is what they were testing. And that test is what led to the accident.
All right, so what happened with the test?
It relied on them turning the reactor off and then doing this rundown test. And this was supposed to be over extremely quickly, 36 seconds. But in preparing for the test, the reactor operator made a mistake. And the mistake meant that the reactor power fell almost to zero. Now, under these circumstances, the regulations said that if the reactor comes almost to accidental shutdown, you're just supposed to shut it down and leave it alone and abandon anything that you might be doing with it. So what they were supposed to do at this point was just shut the reactor down. It was due for a maintenance shutdown anyway. But what this would have meant was that this test, which had already been postponed for almost 3 years, would have to be postponed again for another 3 years. And they really wanted to get this test done. So the deputy chief engineer who was in charge of running the test insisted that they brought the reactor up to power again. And in so doing, they put the reactor in an extremely unstable condition. And they'd done this by 1 o'clock in the morning on April the 26th. And really at that point, some serious accident was almost inevitable. The condition that they put the reactor into, because they had withdrawn all these safety rods from the reactor, was effectively like cocking the hammer on a revolver. And there were design faults within the reactor that they were ignorant of, that meant that once they inserted the rods back into the reactor, it would be like pulling the trigger on the pistol, and there would be a massive cataclysm. And that's what happened.
And that's what happened. But describe what happened. I mean, there was an explosion. It's kind of, when you talk about a book being theater of the mind, I mean, my imagination is running wild as I'm trying to picture that. And you have a lot of photographs in there too, but I got the sense that it is even hard to describe all the chaos, all the destruction of this plant with what happened next, just because there was so much.
Yeah, there was a lot happening simultaneously. And part of the reason that it proved very difficult to deal with for the operators and then for the government commission that came in afterwards is that all of these terrible things happened simultaneously and nobody really knew what was going on. So the test was being conducted by these guys in the control room of the reactor. So there was a massive explosion. But from their perspective, you know, what happened is the walls of the room shook and plaster fell from the ceiling and the lights winked out. But, you know, the room didn't immediately fill with kind of radioactive steam and flame. I mean, because the reactor was some distance away. So it was only those people who were immediately in the central hall or immediately adjacent to the reactor itself that felt the full force of what had happened.
And, yeah, so those people, there were some that were killed immediately. What's going on in the rest of the plant?
Only one man was killed immediately.
And am I correct, they never found his body?
They never found his body. I mean, partly because, we don't know, either because he was blown to pieces by the force of the explosion or that his body was simply buried under a load of intensely radioactive debris. And so his body was lost and then could not be recovered because where his body lies is too dangerous to enter.
But, okay, so one death immediately, but a lot of injuries. And by a lot,
yes.
Several dozen injuries right at the very beginning, right?
Yeah, I mean, within 10 days of the explosion, 130 people had been hospitalized in Moscow alone. And more had been hospitalized in Kiev. And those people almost all suffered severe radiation injuries as a result of that initial explosion.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Today's program featuring Adam Higginbotham discussing his best-selling book, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster, was recorded at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. Please do not call into the station. Now, you said that the operators who were in the control room didn't realize, they knew something was wrong because of the wall
they knew,
shaking. They
knew
something was wrong.
Yeah.
But it took everyone a while, some time, before they realized the true extent of what had happened.
Right. And partly because a lot of them, I think, or several of them certainly, including the station director, Viktor Bryukhanov, experienced some kind of psychological breakdown, I think, whereby, regardless of what they could see with their own eyes, they refused to believe that what had happened had actually happened. And there are several accounts of nuclear specialists who knew exactly what they were looking at, just refusing to believe that something this catastrophic could possibly have happened. I mean, partly because they'd been led to believe that this reactor they were working with was very safe and it was impossible for it to explode.
So what was the damage? What did it look like? In the days afterwards, there were helicopters going over, even though it probably wasn't safe. But there were a lot of people trying to get a look inside to see that reactor and exactly what happened. What did it look like?
Well, first of all, the explosion through the lid of the reactor, which was this 2,000-ton disc.
Wasn't connected. It was just the gravity was holding it on, right?
Exactly.
Right.
So there was this massive explosion, steam explosion, followed, I think, by a hydrogen explosion, although nobody's quite certain. So one, two, or possibly three explosions. But one of these explosions tore the reactor core itself apart and threw this lid in the air. So it ended up tilted on top of the reactor vessel, but open to the air. And the explosion, one of the three explosions was so enormous that it simply obliterated the top of the building that was covering the reactor. So that just disappeared. So the entire building was open to the atmosphere, and beneath it, the reactor was open to the atmosphere. And as the explosion took place, these thousands of tons of graphite that were part of the reactor core immediately caught fire. So then you'd got the reactor was just on fire in a fire that continued for at least 10 days, and that really no one on Earth knew how to put out.
How much radiation was being released at that point?
A lot.
In the book, he's a little more specific than that.
Yeah, I can't remember what the exact figures are, but enough to, you know, to make it fatal to stand anywhere near it for any length of time.
Now, this is going, it's happening over several days. So they're learning, as Adam mentioned, many of the Soviet scientists and nuclear engineers just didn't think anything like this could happen. So some of them weren't even believing their own eyes or what they had heard over the telephone. But, you know, one of the things that they were concerned with was the China syndrome, The Danger of the China Syndrome. And again, here in central Pennsylvania, we've heard about the China Syndrome, the movie that came out just before the Three Mile Island accident in 1979, idea being that a meltdown, a reactor core goes through cement and into the earth and hypothetically burn its way all the way to China. Well, apparently, they were very concerned, and it could have happened, right? I don't know about the part all the way to China, but burning into the earth.
Well, as it turns out, the China Syndrome, that's actually geographically and geologically impossible.
I thought so.
Because I can't remember where the plant in the movie is. I think it's in California, right?
Right.
But if you draw a line from California to the other side of the earth, it doesn't...
Okay, so you mean that part is...
It doesn't come out in China. they were terrified that this was going to happen. Not least because Evgeny Velikov, who was one of the principal scientists in control of the what they call the liquidation of the consequences of the disaster, had recently seen the China Syndrome screened at Moscow State University, and so he apparently was particularly preoccupied with the concept of the China Syndrome. But no, they were concerned that first of all, they had no real idea what was going on inside what remained of the reactor building because it was so dangerous to approach that they couldn't get close enough to take any effective readings. So all of their, what would you call them, projections of what was going on inside the building were based on atmospheric readings of the isotope composition of the air and remote temperature readings that they took using a temperature monitor that they fired towards the reactor from a helicopter. But they had no way of knowing exactly what was going on. So they made the worst case, they came up with the worst case scenario projections that they could. And one of those was that this molten blob of nuclear fuel and what came to be called corium, as the nuclear fuel absorbed things from around it, parts of the building, parts of the reactor itself, sand that was subsequently dropped onto the reactor from the air by helicopter, it had become hot enough that it was burning through the concrete base of the reactor vessel and then was going to burn all the way through the subsequent basement levels of the reactor building until it reached the earth, and then it would continue burning at like a meter and a half a day through the earth until they feared it would reach the water table, at which point it would either create an enormous explosion, even worse than the first one, or it would simply contaminate the water table of the River Pripyat. The River Pripyat was a tributary of the Dnieper, which is the fifth largest river in Europe, but it provided most of the drinking water to Western Ukraine and ultimately fed into the Black Sea. So what they feared was that even if there wasn't a huge explosion, it was going to contaminate the entire Black Sea with radioactivity.
So how did they stop it from melting through the cement foundation and into the earth?
Well, the truth is, it stopped on its own. They didn't stop it. They did a lot of things to try and stop it, but they were almost all completely pointless. And, you know, hundreds of men were sent into action in various different attempts to stop it from happening. And they took what was a sort of traditional Soviet approach. Rather than fixing on one method to stop this happening, they just tried everything at once. So they thought that they would put gaseous oxygen into what remained of the reactor building in order to starve the fire of oxygen and therefore put the fire out. They attempted to inject liquid nitrogen into the ground beneath the reactor building in order to freeze the soil and stop this molten mass melting through it. And they also launched this effort to build a massive heat exchanger in the ground directly beneath the reactor building, which they did actually complete. But by that time, they realized that the meltdown wasn't going to happen. And so they built this enormous thing, and it was never even turned on.
I want to take a step back for just a moment, because how this was handled by the Soviets after the accident is a bizarre story. I mean, it is just an incredible story. But what led up to the accident at Chernobyl is just as interesting, because there had been incidents and accidents at Soviet nuclear plants before Chernobyl, including some at Chernobyl, but accidents that were worse than Three Mile Island. One where there was a partial meltdown?
There was a partial meltdown in reactor one at Chernobyl in 1982.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another where there were 15 men boiled alive?
Yes, where they inadvertently released steam into a compartment where men were working. Yeah.
Yeah. So in 1979, here in central Pennsylvania, when there was the accident at Three Mile Island, which is still considered this nation's worst commercial nuclear accident. But after reading your book, realizing that there really is no comparison, but the Three Mile Island accident was not publicized in the Soviet Union, which in a way is a bit of a surprise because obviously the Soviets wanted anything that came from the West, they wanted to look bad. But they didn't publicize Three Mile Island. Why?
No, although it was certainly mentioned after the Chernobyl accident happened. Because they didn't want to bring the nuclear industry into disrepute. They really, you know, they regarded the nuclear industry worldwide as sharing the same reputation. I mean, in very much the same way as the International Atomic Energy Agency regarded this accident after it happened. They wanted to make the nuclear industry worldwide seem as safe as it possibly could. So they did not disseminate a lot of information about Three Mile Island inside the Soviet Union after 1979.
The design of the reactor at Chernobyl was a huge part of this disaster. RMBK. But it wasn't addressed. I mean, they had several incidents involving, or there were flaws with these reactors before, but there was no information sharing amongst the other nuclear plants in the Soviet Union.
That's right.
If some of that information had been shared, could it have stopped, or maybe it wouldn't have been as bad at Chernobyl?
I think it would probably have stopped it happening because the truth is that the designers of the reactor knew of many of these faults 10 years before the accident happened. But a lot of the fixes were slow-walked, and other fixes weren't attempted in the first place. So, you know, if any of those design faults had been addressed, then the accident may not have happened. And as you say, there were other accidents. There was an accident that happened with the first RBMK reactor that was built in Leningrad in the early 70s, but information about that was covered up and kept even from people at other nuclear plants in the Soviet nuclear industry. Each of these accidents was regarded as a state secret.
Without getting too far in the weeds, getting too technical, what were some of the flaws with this reactor?
Well, the worst one, the most kind of startling one, is the one that was the ultimate proximate cause of the explosion, which was that the emergency control rods that were used to shut down the reactor in the case of an emergency, but also even if you wanted to turn it off under any circumstances, for example, for a routine maintenance shutdown, the control rods are inserted into the core of the reactor and it's designed to quench the chain reaction inside the core. So it's supposed to slow it down and ultimately stop it. But what they had discovered as recently as 1983 at another nuclear plant in Kursk was that another RBMK plant in Kursk was that for a split second when those rods were first inserted into the core, instead of slowing the reaction down as you would expect, as they were designed to do, they would increase the rate of reaction. So it was as if the accelerator and the brakes of a car had been wired in reverse. So you're driving along a road in your new car, a deer leaps out in front of you, you stamp on the brakes, and instead of slowing down and stopping, the car suddenly leaps forward and becomes far, much faster. And that was the sort of most terrifying design defect that they had discovered before the accident, but done nothing to address.
And this isn't just one instance of when the plant was constructed that there were flaws. I mean, even parts that were manufactured in the Soviet Union, equipment that came to Chernobyl had to be torn apart and reassembled because they were built so poorly. I mean, that's hard for anyone to fathom, but apparently this is something that happened on a regular basis in the Soviet Union.
It was that this is I think the term, the literal translation is pre-erection overhaul, which was an additional stage in Soviet construction throughout Soviet industry that I was told about by the former Ukrainian energy minister, who told me that he only discovered for the first time that this was not universal practice in other countries in a meeting with the British energy minister in London, when he happened to mention it in front of this guy in a meeting. And after the translator spoke, noticed all the British energy workers in the room looking slightly bewildered. And he said that he thought that the translator had just sort of screwed this up. And then he was embarrassed to discover that actually pre-erection overhaul is not a standard part of the construction process in other nuclear plants.
After the disaster at Chernobyl, the first Soviet inclination, as anything that made the Soviet Union look bad, was to keep everything quiet. And they did that in the immediate days after the accident at Chernobyl. Even from the people who lived closest, people who worked at the plant, they tried to keep it quiet, right?
That's right. In fact, there's one guy I spoke to who was one of the nuclear liaisons to the Central Committee of Moscow, told me that he thought that the KGB had actually deliberately tried to cut off telephone communication between workers who were reporting what was going on and their superiors in Moscow on the night of the accident.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Today's program featuring Adam Higginbotham discussing his best-selling book, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster, was recorded at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. Please do not call into the station. The world finally found out, I say finally, it was a couple days later, about Chernobyl because radiation levels went up in Sweden.
That's right.
700 miles from Chernobyl.
That's right.
How did that happen?
Well, I mean, the Soviet government took what they regarded as the traditional approach to releasing information, which was initially to deny that anything had happened. But obviously, they couldn't. What they discovered is that unlike other nuclear accidents that had taken place closer to the interior of the USSR, where nuclear material had spread a long way, but partly because the wind was blowing in the opposite direction, partly because it was a long way from the borders of the Soviet Union, they could keep that quiet. But in this case, there was this massive release of radiation that began drifting all across northern and western Europe. And so what happened is that by Sunday evening, that cloud of radioactive material had reached Finland and Sweden. And late on Sunday night, it fell as rain over an area near this nuclear plant, Forsmark, in Sweden. And so one of the members of the chemical testing laboratory inside Forsmark discovered when he came into work on Monday morning that he was setting off the radiation alarms at the entrance of the building. And he was slightly bewildered by this because he hadn't been inside the reactor block at that point. He'd just been having his morning coffee. So he thought, well, what can possibly be, how can I be contaminated? It's not possible. And he and the radiation dosimetrist from the plant just thought that the machine for measuring radiation at the entrance of the plant had been miscalibrated. So they both went back to work. But then when he came down for another coffee a bit later, because this is Sweden and they have a lot of coffee breaks.
It's probably a good thing.
In this case, certainly. He discovered that there was this huge line of guys who were all setting off the radiation alarm at the entrance to the plant because they'd walked in through the parking lot and all of their shoes were contaminated with radiation from the ground outside where the rain had fallen.
700 miles from Chernobyl.
That's right.
So how many people were exposed after the disaster at Chernobyl in Europe?
Well, all of Europe was exposed.
All?
Yeah, I mean, because apart from anything else, there was the initial explosion. So this huge cloud escaped at 1:30 in the morning on the Saturday. But after that, the fire burned for 10 days. So this plume of radiation just, if you look at it, there's a there's an interesting animated map which depicts just the cesium contamination, and you can see that it begins kind of swirling out to the north and west, and then gradually different tails of this stuff began circulating all the way around the map and spreading out in sort of concentric circles. Ultimately, radiation from Chernobyl, radioactive material from Chernobyl, spread throughout the northern hemisphere.
So once this is discovered in Sweden, and the world catches on that something had happened. Now, there was some misreporting. I mean, one of the New York papers, was it, had reported...
The New York Post.
15,000 people dead.
Immediately, as far as the Post was concerned. All of their corpses buried as nuclear waste somewhere in Ukraine.
So they were off a little bit with that story.
Just a bit.
But the world wanted more information, but with Soviet newscast on TV... One of the very first stories that the accident at Chernobyl was 21st in the list of stories that they had done. So there were 20 other stories in the Soviet Union that were more important to their viewers that night than the accident at Chernobyl. And again, at first, the Soviets tried to keep a lid on this, and they didn't want to evacuate the people around the plant. There were some who were saying, listen, we got to evacuate. But there were others saying...
Yeah, there were disagreements about that, to be fair.
So when did evacuation orders come down? How many people? How far out from the plant?
The town of Pripyat was only evacuated eventually on Sunday afternoon. So the explosion took place at just before 1:30 on Saturday morning. And then people weren't evacuated until 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
In the meantime, people are living their normal lives on a Saturday and a Sunday. Kids out riding their bikes, playing.
School was on throughout. The kids went to school on Saturday mornings throughout the Soviet Union. So all the kids in Pripyat went to school as normal on Saturday morning.
And May Day, biggest holiday in the Soviet Union, was coming up the next weekend or that next week. So people were preparing for this holiday. So.
What you got to remember is it was a beautiful sunny day. It was a really warm, unseasonably warm late spring day. So people just went out on the streets. They went swimming in the river. They went to the sand pit, the sandboxes with their kids. People just went about their business as they would do if it was a nice day.
So describe that evacuation, the first one that came down on Sunday afternoon.
So that was the evacuation that evacuated. It was the one part of the Soviet response to the accident. Although it took place late, it was remarkably efficient. And they evacuated 27,500 people in less than 3 hours from Pripyat. They brought in 1,200 buses, a couple of trains, and some boats, and they just got everybody out in a very short period of time.
What about the environment afterwards? I mean, even here in central Pennsylvania, after Three Mile Island, there were people who told stories about birth defects of not humans, but of farm animals, maybe plants that were growing differently. What about the environment after the Chernobyl accident?
Well, this is an extremely fraught question because, you may have seen one of these documentaries or magazine articles which talk about this sort of miracle of the exclusion zone, which subscribes to this kind of Gaian concept that, Mother Earth has staged this remarkable recovery in the wake of this radioactive catastrophe, and that wildlife seems to be thriving. And there are the wolves and this rare breed of prehistoric horses, and birds of prey return to the zone. And so this is used as part of an argument that, actually, the radioactive contamination is something that nature has simply shrugged off. But it seems that the truth is that before the accident, although it was a very bucolic-seeming environment, it was nonetheless an industrial zone with a power plant at the center of it, added to which it was pretty heavily populated and also an area which was collectively farmed. And the Ukrainians are pretty enthusiastic hunters and fishermen. So what happened after the evacuation was that there were no people left in the exclusion zone. So obviously, nobody going out with fishing rods, nobody stalking through the woods with rifles. So yes, wild animals, wild boar, wolves, have indeed returned to live in the zone, and they've been reproducing, and there are a lot more of them than there were in 1986. But a team of scientists has pretty firmly established that radiation exposure, even chronic low-level radiation exposure, is not good for animals. So they do suffer from birth defects, they do suffer from deformities, and some suffer from early death. So I'm afraid the only conclusion that we can draw is that although radiation is bad for animals, then human beings are probably a lot worse.
All right, so you mentioned a few minutes ago, when I used the word hire, about people being pressed into service. Eventually, there were 600,000 people pressed into service.
Over the course of 4 or 5 years.
Four or five years. And correct me if I'm wrong, they did not have a choice. I mean, there were people who were what we would refer to as being drafted.
No, they were absolutely drafted. Most of them eventually were military reservists
and
who were called up.
Had no choice, that they were sent to clean up and whatever else had to happen with Chernobyl.
Well, you could pay a bribe.
Oh, okay.
You could pay a bribe to the recruiting officer. Interestingly, if you had been drafted to serve in Afghanistan, it would cost you twice as much to pay off the recruiting officer to stop being sent to Kabul than it would to Chernobyl.
Why is that?
I guess even Chernobyl was deemed to be less dangerous than being sent to Afghanistan in the late 80s.
Wow. One final question that I have. In the book, you say that Chernobyl was one of the initial steps that led to the fall of the Soviet Union. How?
I think that the most significant contribution it made was in the way it affected Mikhail Gorbachev's thinking about the work he had to do to address the problems that he inherited with what he called the problems of the era of stagnation that preceded him. Because before the accident, although he talked about glasnost and perestroika, about openness and about restructuring the economy, he hadn't really done anything about it, partly because he was concerned that he'd be turfed out of office by conservatives within the Politburo if he was seen to be too much of a reformer. But what's clear is that the accident, and specifically the investigation into the causes of the accident, made him realize exactly how corrupt the system that he'd inherited was. So it convinced him that he had to stop approaching this idea of reforming gingerly, as he had been, and really plunge very deeply into it. But the result of that was that he went about these economic reforms in particular much too quickly. And if it was ever potentially possible to change the Soviet economy in the way that he intended successfully, it could not be done the way that he went about doing it. And those changes were really one of the most significant contributing factors to the fall of the Soviet Union. The economic reforms were botched. They were done much too quickly, and the whole country fell apart. But at the same time, you know, the way in which he brought glasnost to bear on the accident itself helped change the minds of Soviet people about the way they thought about their government. And so they discovered for the first time exactly the extent to which they'd been lied to through the prism of the Chernobyl disaster. So I think that also is a pretty significant factor in what happened subsequently.
Our thanks to Adam Higginbotham, author of Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster, and Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg, where we recorded this conversation. And thank you for listening to Smart Talk.